he has a polola, as we call it in Chile, or a girlfriend. And we don't know, this will be the first girlfriend in La Moneda, right, in the presidential palace. And he's very open. He's very progressive. There's something so refreshing about him, so joyful about him. And he represents the movement that in the last 2 years has asked for a new Chile to be reborn, you know? And I myself feel as if this is part of my own experience. I mean, I've just written a novel called The Compensation Bureau, in which I deal with precisely how we can move forward with all the pain that we have lived with in the past. And also what we do with the perpetrators. What do we do with the José Antonio castes? How do we deal with them? How do we make sure that, you know, I'm against punishing them. I'm trying to find ways in which we can convince those people who are our enemies to at least join the democratic conversation rather than being opposed to it.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, and we are going to check back next week after the runoff election on Sunday. Ariel Dorfman is a Chilean-American author, distinguished professor emeritus of literature at Duke University. We'll link to your op-ed in The Guardian. I Live Through the Darkness of the Pinochet Era. Is Chile Heading Back There? And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Computer land. Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio on your community radio station, the one and only mighty KBOO, talking at you out of our Southeast studios here in Portland, Oregon. But we go out more widely through our two transmitters in the Columbia River Gorge and down in the Mid-Willamette River Valley at Philomath. And of course, via the World Wide Web. This is our end of the year membership drive. If you're just hearing about it, well, this is your opportunity to jump in with both feet and support this vital, important community resource, community service. Listener-sponsored radio. So go to kboo.fm or kboo.fm/give. Click on that donate button, and or you can text KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device, or you can mail us your check or money order to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. We are working our way up to our goal of $45,000, and we can't get there without your help. Every little bit counts. Every big bit counts even more if you're able to do that. We really appreciate it. I'm going to be offering 5 copies of the book that we're going to be talking about today with the author of the book, Richard Heinberg, who ought to be on the line with us right now. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Paul. Good to be with you again.
Yes, yes. It's been a while, a few years. And I know you had been on a fair amount with Andrew Geller, I believe, before me. And I don't know, I may have even had you on before I left the country for a number of years. I think I may have. But anyway, it's so good to have you on now. Let me just give a little bit of an introduction. You're a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and author of 13 previous books. I'm going to name a few of those because I think it's important to kind of see, you know, the trajectory, how you led up to this truly monumental book. I can't speak highly enough of Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival, a very timely book and an important subject. So it's a sweeping and in-depth investigation of the workings of power in both the natural and social worlds. Of course, the emphasis on the social world, because humans, as you talk about, have sort of appropriated the power over the rest of the world and doing a lot of damage with it. It traces how 4 key elements developed to give humans extraordinary power: tool-making ability, language, social complexity, and the ability to harness energy sources, most significantly fossil fuels. It asks whether we have at this point overpowered natural and social systems, and if we have, what can we do about it? You're also on the advisory board of the Climate Mobilization, a grassroots advocacy group calling for a national economic mobilization against climate change on the scale of the home front during World War I with the goal of 100% clean energy. Are you still on that, with that group?
Yeah, I'm still on the advisory board.
Okay, because sometimes these things are a little out of date. I just want to check. So, yeah, I just want to look at a few of these. You know, you've been talking about the whole issue of peak oil and peak energy in general, which then, of course, has had a fate that has just added to the crisis by going after the harder and harder and more polluting energy sources. But you wrote back in 2005, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. Then Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines. Blackout, Coal, Climate, and the Last Energy Crisis, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, and you can get the picture. But this book is something, you're kind of leading up to this book, it seems like. Maybe talk a little bit about how you led up to this book and why you felt the need to write such a really comprehensive look at history and society.
Right. Well, as you say, I've been writing about energy issues and environmental issues for many years, but it wasn't until really just a few years ago that the real core of my concerns started to coalesce into 3 questions. First, how has just one species out of millions come to dominate the planet? Second, how have we come to dominate one another in so many ways? There are lots of other social species on the planet, you know, insects and bees and prairie dogs and you know, dozens of other examples. But even though they have their hierarchies, they seldom, you know, press the issues to the point where they exterminate one another. You know, we human beings have taken social power to real extremes. Well, why has that happened and how has that happened? And then the third question is there anything we can do about our relationship with power to avert the overwhelming environmental and social crises that we seem to be headed toward? So those 3 questions were really the guiding stars of my process of writing the book. And of course, to answer those questions, you really have to go into a lot of different areas of subject matter, anthropology, economics, history, environmental studies, and so on. So I wanted to be up to date in my I've had interest in all of those subjects for decades, but I wanted to be up to date in my understanding of them. So I went on a book buying spree, and in each of those subject areas, I found who I considered to be the most leading edge thinkers doing the most important primary research, and read scores, literally scores of books. And it was the intellectual a project of a lifetime, I have to say. I as you say, I've written a lot of other books. I know how to do book research and so on, but I've never undertaken anything like this before. It was pretty amazing. So that's how the book came to be.
Well, it's a little heartening to those of us who don't have the discipline and the stick-with-itness that it takes to do such a project that you already did have interest in a lot of these areas, because if you had just started from scratch, I mean, it really is, it's a real service to us. I mean, I interview a fair number of book authors with this show, and, obviously I believe in all of them, both the authors and the books themselves. This just seems to be just almost another level in terms of the importance, because I've been, I've been grappling with a lot of those same questions for most of my adult life as well. And to find someone who really puts it together in a way that I just find incredibly helpful, to the extent that that's going to actually help us is an important question. Obviously people have to read it and talk about it. Whether, that will happen, this show hopefully will contribute a little bit to that. But so I guess maybe just to launch into it, talk about the organization of the book itself. I think it's really helpful, just the chapters themselves. Maybe you could kind of just give a quick sketch, and then we can sort of go deeper into some of the, what both of us consider some of the more important questions to look at.
Sure. Well, the book is about power, and it's a natural history of power. So I start with power in nature, and power has many definitions, especially in English. Power can be the rate of energy transfer. That's how a physicist would define power. But then we use energy to do things, and so the ability to do something is power. We speak of the power of flight or the power of speech, and so on. But then there's also social power, and some languages actually have a different word to denote social power from physical power. But since I write and speak in English, I thought it was useful to be able to bring those meanings together in under one heading for the purposes of the book. So social power, if power is the ability to do something, social power is the ability to get other people to do something. So the book explores both kinds of power. First, power in the natural world, and that's the subject of chapter one, how power evolved from single-cell organisms all the way up to diverse ecosystems. Energy is essential to everything, and the ability to appropriate energy and use it to accomplish necessary tasks is really the essence of evolution. So the second chapter is human evolution. How did we human beings become as powerful as we are? Well, the story starts hundreds of thousands of years ago with the origin of Homo sapiens itself. And there were many other species of human for tens of thousands of years, but just one of those species, sapiens, succeeded while all the others failed. So what's the reason for that? And the experts are not all unified on that point, but language, the acquisition of language, seems to have been one of the keys in making that happen. Of course, there was tool making, there was the ability to control fire, clothing, and so on, but language was especially key to social power, making human beings collectively more formidable against other groups of human beings. Then we get to chapter 3, which is about, there's 7 chapters, by the way. Chapter 3 is about the evolution of vertical social power. If social power is the ability to get other people to do things, well, there are 2 different kinds of social power. One is horizontal power, where we all decide together to do something, and that's what we enjoyed mostly as hunter-gatherers. But with the origin of the early state societies, with kings and their full-time division of labor, taxation, writing, metal weapons, and all of those things that all pretty much developed together, with that we get vertical social power, where one person or a few people can tell a lot of other people what to do, using threats and incentives. So chapter 3 is the origin of social power. Chapter 4 is the more recent development of extreme world-changing power. Chapters 2 and 3 really take human social evolution up to the last couple of hundred years, when suddenly all hell breaks loose, and that's the fossil fuel revolution. Before that, we had been using energy from food, from firewood, from domesticated animals, the muscle power of domesticated animals and enslaved human beings. But now suddenly we had energy that had been produced by nature, tens of millions of years of ancient sunlight gathered and concentrated by natural processes into storable, portable fuels, and they have enabled us to do things that were undreamt of previously. It's energy that enables us to do anything whatever, and suddenly having access to enormous amounts of energy enabled us to do everything faster and on a larger scale. So our energy consumption has increased 8-fold in the last 200 years on a per capita basis. But then the number of capitas has also increased 8-fold, from 1 billion to 8 billion human beings. And we've taken over the entire biosphere as a result. Chapter 5 is titled Overpowered. It's about what's happened as a result of our taking so much power over the environment and so much power over one another so quickly as we have in the last couple of hundred years. And it's the warning signs are everywhere, from climate change to growing economic inequality to disappearance of wild nature, all kinds of pollution other than CO2 in the atmosphere, and so on. And I argue that these are all not just technical problems that we can solve, just with a little more economic growth or with, a new technology to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. These are problems of power. The only way to solve these problems will be for humanity to reduce its power over nature to some degree, and for some human beings to give up some of their power over others, the rich to give up their wealth and powerful nations with atomic weapons to give up those potentially world destroying weapons. But is that even possible? Is it possible for human beings to give up power? And that's the subject of chapter 6. And I argue in that chapter that self-limitation of power is in fact inherent in nature and in human history. Everywhere you look, there are ways of balancing power relations in ecosystems. Even in individual organisms, we have what's known as homeostasis, which is a moment-by-moment power balancing act that every organism experiences. but then all the way up through human history to the present, really. I mean, today we understand that we have to prevent environmental excesses. We have the Endangered Species Act and Clean Water, Clean Air Acts and so on. We have a progressive taxation to keep some people from getting too wealthy. We have all kinds of laws to keep people from cheating. We have democracy to keep tyrants from arising and so on. But the question is, if we can limit power, if it's in our very DNA to do so, then why aren't we doing a good enough job now? Why are we faced with these potentially world-destroying crises from climate change on? And I think I explore a number of answers to that question, but the one that I think is most persuasive is just that fossil fuels have given us so much power so quickly that we've developed an implicit ideology that says that we human beings will always have more, that even if we destroy the planet, we can jet off to other planets and take over them as well. It's a frontier mentality. It's a colonizing mentality. Clearly, it has its roots, 500 years ago in the European takeover of the rest of the planet. But fossil fuels have taken that attitude and put it on steroids to the point where we believe that economic growth has to go on forever, and that there are no limits to what human beings can accomplish. All we need is just a little more energy, a little more technology, and we can solve anything. So that being the case, Chapter 7 says, well, where are we headed? What's the likelihood for our species in the remainder of this century? And, I don't try to forecast a particular path, but I do say that the range of possibilities is bounded. On one end, by the possibility of human extinction, which I think is very real this century, and on the other end, by sufficient self-limitation. In other words, I don't think that there's a likely future in which we, humanity, continue to aggregate more and more power, in which our economies continue to grow and grow and grow and so on. There aren't enough resources to enable that. There's not enough space in the environment for all the wastes that would be produced. No, the future is bounded either by self-annihilation or sufficient self-limitation. And I talk about ways that we could sufficiently limit ourselves, not just carbon emissions, but also inequality and the space that we take up in the natural world that's causing so many other species to decline. And where we actually come out in all of this will depend on the choices we make, and it's not so much a long range theoretical problem. It's a very short term, very real problem that we all have to deal with. Regardless of our age, the rest of our lives are going to be spent dealing with these issues.
Well, thank you for that. Succinct, because this is a big book, a very complex book by the nature of the subject matter. And that was Richard Heinberg. I got a request to spell your name. Not everybody can just click on their computer and go to whatever website and look up the name of the book, which is Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival, again by Richard Heinberg. That's HEINBERG. And as I said, you're with the Post Carbon Institute, have been for quite some time, written quite a few other important books on the subject of energy generally. But this one is Power itself. And I really, I've been grappling again in my dilettante, unfocused way about the, how do we bring together, there used to be the two cultures argument. There's various ways of cutting it, but the difference between the physical world and the social world, and power does seem to be a real excellent way of focusing. It's in a way kind of a unified field theory of power, if I may be so bold as to make such a statement. As I mentioned, this we are in our end of the year membership drive, and do need to take a little bit of time out of our programming, including this interview, because that's the way we bring these interviews with you, the way that I bring my program every week and the other talk show hosts, Democracy Now!, all the other public affairs programs, all the music programs, all the culture programs. You know, 24/7 we come at you on this community radio station. And the way to keep it going is by people pitching in, everybody pitching in, and that's the way we get our power. Our power is our, we run on electricity, which does cost money and has other costs too. We're not unaware of that. Our power is the power of our signal. We actually have three signals, as I said, out of Portland, out of Hood River, and out of actually White Salmon, and out of Philomath, and of course over the computer. These are all forms of power, and our power is in the messages, in the content as well. And if you appreciate that content, we really hope you will go to kboo.fm/give. And if we're offering copies of this book for a $60 regular membership donation or more. So if you give $60 or more during this hour, you will automatically be considered for a copy of this book, Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival by Richard Heinberg, my guest. You could also just, when you call up 503-231-8187, we're going to be inviting callers in a few minutes. You can also let Ty, our board operator, know that you want to copy the book, and he'll write down your information. That's another way to do that. But again, if you go to kboo.fm or if you text KBOO to 44321, you will be, during this hour, you'll be automatically considered for a copy of this book if you give $60 or more. I want to kind of jump ahead to sort of the end. We can kind of go back and forth. You know, you're talking about both optimum power is your sixth chapter, how the idea of self-limitation both in natural ecosystems, in individual organisms, even in societies, and then, you know, the future of power, how we, you know, are we able to do that? The clock is ticking. I think we're all more and more aware of that, especially when we have super tornadoes. Talk about power. It just rip right through our society. And you talk about how in some societies, I mean, you talk about even in mass, you know, industrial society, through the legislation, through policies, there are checks and balances through taxation. But I was really interested, you know, I've been familiar with this, but some of the mechanisms in smaller scale societies. You mentioned, you know, hunter-gatherer, but they're also can be operable in you know, small horticulture societies. There's different mechanisms, including, as you say, some of the problem is, we talk about sort of how evolution works, and sort of then cultural evolution sort of takes that to a different level. But how evolution works, in it works through, you know, mutations, through changes, genetic changes, and then in cultural evolution through cultural changes, and how they get, some get adopted, some are, you know, some further power, individual social power, and the ability to survive and thrive, and, you know, through, you know, human beings especially, dominate. Dominating doesn't work so well in small scale face-to-face groups, where it can disrupt the functioning of the group, the survival of the group. So, you know, you get certain individuals who are either overly greedy, overly assertive, have too much dominant tendencies. there's a lot of pushback against that in those societies, to the extent even of banishment or capital punishment. And my theory, I don't actually know, I didn't read the entire book cover to cover, but I don't know if you talk about this, but my personal feeling is that part of the way that we got into the mess we're in through vertical power is, in fact, the avoidance of those basic mechanisms, the ability of certain individuals to get around or to overpower those mechanisms. So that's a real problem, because then you get large-scale societies where you have elites that can basically run rampant. You have corporate dictatorship, basically, or you have real dictatorship and people committing genocide and whatever. So you talk about different kinds of checks and balances, but it's difficult to rein that in. So why don't we just jump right into that? How do we deal with that basic paradox?
Right. Well, that's what determines the success or failure of societies overall. When we get to complex human societies, societies based on grain agriculture with full-time division of labor, we find also that those societies almost always have what some anthropologists have called wealth pump. In other words, the people at the top of the social pyramid make the rules for the society as a whole, and so their tendency is to make those rules to their own advantage, so that over time the wealth of society gets vacuumed up to the top of the social pyramid. And what happens then is that gradually the people at the bottom of the social pyramid become immiserated. They don't have enough to make their lives, work. And meanwhile, everyone can see the advantages of being at the top of the social pyramid, so the elite aspirants, those who want to be among the elites, become more and more numerous and begin to fight with one another ever more ferociously until the whole thing breaks down. Peter Turchin, who is he actually began as an insect ecologist, and he used statistical methods for studying problems of insect evolution and solved a bunch of problems in that field. Then he decided to use the same successful methods to study human social evolution. So he's written several books on this in recent years, some really excellent work based on a very wide-ranging collection of data on hundreds of different societies. So he's come to the conclusion that there's a kind of periodicity connected with complex societies, that they tend to go through cycles of expansion and collapse. And we see this again and again. I've just described the mechanism that results in this kind of periodicity. He's very concerned about the United States right now as being in a situation where, because of overproduction of elites and because we have been seeing increasing economic inequality in our country for the last several decades, that we're headed toward, and he's been saying this not just in the last 4 or 5 years, but for the last 10 or 15 years, that we're heading for more political polarization, and especially during this decade, the 2020s, the likelihood of more political violence. I think we're seeing that playing out. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? The only solutions, really, to this are, to reduce the immiseration of those at the bottom of the economic pyramid, to start taxing billionaires out of existence, basically, and spread that wealth around, and start the elites have to start making decisions on behalf of the society as a whole, solving problems rather than just promoting the interests of their in-group. That's a tall order. I don't know if we're going to be able to get there anytime soon before we have some serious political fallout, but until we do, we're in a situation where we can't solve the other big problems that we're facing, like climate change and so on. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think it's what I'm thinking and worrying about these days.
Well, it's kind of something I sort of wanted to lead up to, but now that we're into it, so the whole issue of, you know, how that any activist, you know, any, you know, public intellectual grappling with these issues, you know, any thinking person who sees the horrible mess we've succeeded in getting ourselves into, I use succeeded advisedly. This is the humans, Homo sapiens is an incredible success story, but we also have seen other examples of success stories that have not turned out well for the organism, the species involved, and we could be one of them. But how do you get traction? You know, I forget the name of the new voting rights bill, which does seem to be key towards getting anything else done in the Congress because the way that specifically the Republican Party and certain Democrats have become totally obstructionist and are, you know, basically holding on to their power that they see being threatened, you know, by demographic shifts, by cultural shifts, and they're willing to basically seemingly do anything at this point to hold on to that, including take the our democratic system down with them. I admire people who are working tirelessly, you know, Stacey Abrams in Georgia and the organization that she started and others, just innumerable people who are on the front lines of doing that work of community organizing, of patient, that does seem to be what needs to be done. However, at a certain point, you know, like when Hitler Mussolini rose to power, for example, there's a need to do something more. And I guess one wonders, you know, you seem to dismiss, and I'll let you certainly obviously respond to this, you kind of dismiss what to me was the real epical attempt to reverse the trend of social power, which was, you know, the socialist communist movement, which had, you know, its own success, and then right. turned it to different. But the idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat as being, which I've never really agreed with, but in the face of what's going on, you know, since the idea that, okay, let me just try to formulate this thought. So, in small-scale societies, you have these mechanisms of banishment and capital punishment, the extreme mechanism. You have other lesser forms of, you know, peer criticism and just forms of keeping people in check. But, you know, when extreme things happen, when someone is like a mutant that is disrupting the social cohesion of the group, you need to do something more because you have to survive in, you know, precarious circumstances, whether you're hunter-gatherer or horticulture or whatever. So, you know, the equivalent of that seems to be something like, you know, a revolutionary movement that seizes the reins of power. And, you know, I don't know. It just seems like we are in increasingly desperate times, but we don't even seem to be able to summon that up. It seems like those days are almost gone as well. You know, we don't even have much of a common language or discourse for how we understand the nature of society and social change, which is why, you know, why I'm excited about your book, because it does provide the possibility of some kind of common understanding for a framework. But anyway, that's a big thought. I'll let you go on.
Yeah, when power becomes too concentrated and overly corrupted, then revolution is one of the mechanisms by which balance returns. Sometimes it happens just through social collapse, and the center does not hold, and a large-scale society fragments into smaller units. I don't know what's going to happen in this instance. I think both of those are possibilities. But we do seem to be living in a time when the center is becoming increasingly fragile. Over the longer term, clearly societies are going to succeed better and for longer when they have the kinds of mechanisms that we've been talking about for maintaining more horizontal power and discouraging vertical power, and especially the corruption of vertical power. In small-scale human societies, people are valorized and appreciated for their willingness to sacrifice themselves on behalf of the group as a whole, to give away their wealth. In the Pacific Northwest, of course, there was the tradition of the potlatch, where the indigenous people on an annual basis would throw big parties, and the person with the most wealth just gave it all away. There are so many examples in indigenous societies of ways of respecting nature's limits, of limiting the group's exploitation of natural resources, to the point where modern ecologists are studying indigenous resource conservation practices for, you know, clues as to how we can, get out of our current environmental dilemmas. So in small-scale societies, there are ways of doing this. And it makes one wonder if the long-term solution is to make sure that society maintains its granularity, that that small-scale organization is maintained, even if we have larger or overarching cooperative arrangements between societies to share information or resources, that nevertheless we maintain decision making within groups where face-to-face conversation can still occur. I think this was one of the inspirations of what was called the bioregional movement back in the 1970s and 80s, where the idea was that rather than organizing ourselves in these giant state societies where people were more or less anonymous from one another and exercised their very minimal powers of choice through the voting booth, that instead, you know, we'd be much better off organizing ourselves bioregionally according to, you know, watersheds and other natural features of the land where people have common interests because they live in the same natural region.
Richard, I know you got a longer thought, and I would like to respect that, but I've been kind of hogging the questions in the conversation with you. And we actually do have three listeners I've already called in. And I also need to remind people about our end of the year membership drive. And we have less than 20 minutes left. So let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, Mark. You are on the air. Oh, see, I spoke so long, I lost Mark.
Oops, we lost Mark.
Go ahead and call back.
Call back, Mark.
And so let me just remind people, I'm listening. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm speaking with Richard Heinberg, the author of Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival. Again, Mark, please call back, 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller is Camilo. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for this excellent program. Mr. Heinberg, there's two factors that you've mentioned. One is the possibility of collapse, and the other is the time dimension that we're facing in order to, I guess, survive. And there are a number of climate scientists who are predicting collapse and that we've reached tipping points and no possibility of returning from the effects that have been put into place. So I wonder whether or not we could say that we're actually looking at collapse, and that along with trying to do everything we can in order to survive by making the changes that you recommend, But I have to comment that relying on elites to make sacrifices does not seem like a very likely solution. And I wonder if, alongside making whatever efforts we can, that we should be considering an adaptation to collapse, doing everything that we can to mitigate the effects of inevitable collapse.
Right, that's a great great question and comment. Well, my short answer is yes. You know, over the course of the next few decades, we'll be seeing profound changes to the environment and to human society. And whether you call that collapse or adaptation or reorganization, I guess will depend somewhat on the choices made, the circumstances. But nevertheless, you know, our current industrial way of life is going away, and we have to design a different way of living on this planet, one that can survive over the long term. And can we look to the elites to do that for us? I don't think so. One of the sections in the book is about recent research on the social psychology of power, and there's been a lot of really amazing research just in the last 10 years on this. It turns out that people with a lot of social power tend to have diminished empathy for others. They are less risk averse. They have more difficulty seeing things from other people's point of view. And so these are the people that we put in charge. So, you know, we just had a big climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland. And who were the people in the room? Well, they were primarily people with a lot of social power. They were exactly the worst people to be able to understand our situation and make the kinds of choices that are needed. And I think that people are starting to understand that. The folks out on the street in Glasgow, the young people and Extinction Rebellion and all the other groups who are looking at this are coming to the conclusion that, you know, the global elites are not going to save us from climate change. If it's going to happen, it has to happen as a broad-scale social movement. So, yes.
That's essentially where I'm coming from. I'm a participant in Extinction Rebellion, and I'm in the Regeneration Working Group. And I think the dynamic is between how quickly we can implement regenerative culture versus how quickly it will be that the natural effects of climate change and our previous decisions and resource distributions, income distributions, will bring about ultimate collapse.
Okay, Camille, I got to let you go. Thank you so much, because we do have another caller, and we only have a little over 10 minutes, and I have to talk about KBOO. This is our end-of-the-year drive. Richard, you can respond to that after just a second. I apologize, but you know the drill. I'm sure you've participated in a number of membership drives on community radio yourself, I imagine. Have you? Richard? Oh, we lost Richard. Okay. Sorry about that. We're getting my guest, Richard Heinberg, author of Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival, back on the line, let me talk about this book a little more and in relation to the end-of-the-year membership drive, which lasts until the end of the year. So you have that much time if you haven't yet donated, contributed. You know, we've added this on because we came up a little short in our last drive. I think we were kind of getting used to the idea that we could actually swing it with these virtual drives without having the whole phone banking thing, which you know, has always been a very successful, kept us going, and we had success with the virtual membership drive for the first two or three during this time, but our last one seemed to fall a little short. And but you know, the costs remain the same of the station. They're fixed costs, as it were, for to keep the station on the air. So we do have to raise that money to keep going. And the way we do it is by appealing to you directly through our airwaves. And that's what I'm doing right now. So I'm talking to you for listening. And if you have not yet stepped up to the plate, I think, Ty, your microphone might be on, or somebody's microphone is on. Anyway, KBOO.fm, go to our website, familiarize yourself with it, check out our programming if you haven't, and click on that donate button if you are able to do that. If you don't have the virtual means to contribute, you can go directly to mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. That's KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. But if you do that way and you want the book, you're going to have to let our board operator know that you want a copy of Power. And if you want an ebook or a paper book, I can't recommend this more. Really, we need to have some common understandings of how the heck we got to the point we're in, and the point, and what the point is that we're in, and if we can do anything about it, and if so, what. And I think a lot of really good information is in here. I think it's just a brilliant overview. He's done a real service to us, Richard Heinberg, and I applaud
Thank
him
so
for
much,
that.
Paul.
And you can get a copy of this book. And join the conversation, join KBOO. You can just do so many things all at once by going to kboo.fm and click on that donate button. You can also text KBOO to 44321, 44321. There's also a mobile app that some of you might be using. You can click donate in that mobile app. But please do it. And please do it during this hour, and you can get a copy of this book, as I said, which I just can't recommend any more highly than I'm doing. 80% of our funding does come from our members. And if you haven't been a member, maybe you're a lapsed member, maybe you've been wondering if you really want to keep being a member of KBOO, and maybe this program has helped convince you. Well, go to our website, kboo.fm. Less than 10% of our listeners are actually members. That's an important thing to keep in mind. So, you can't necessarily depend on everybody else to do that. So anyway, with that, let's go to our last few minutes of our program. And we do have Mike waiting patiently on the line. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Excuse me. It's Mike. I've been thinking about this problem for a really long time, and I wondered if Richard happened to run across any kind of solution-oriented thing around kelp farming. I mean, I saw an interesting TED Talk. I won't go on, but the fellow was talking about, if we were to dedicate a certain amount of, the ocean surface to just growing kelp, which basically grows itself and grows like, as 9 meters a year or something each piece, easy to do, and then you just basically sequester it at the bottom of the ocean, and all that carbon that it sucks out of the ocean, will just go down into that anaerobic lay on the bottom of the abyss, and it'll be sequestered. And his numbers and things that I read beyond that seem to indicate that a massive effort to do that, might be a low-tech solution to decarbonizing the ocean.
Kelp. Check. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, well, I'm all into low-tech solutions, and kelp farming is much more in that category than a lot of the solutions that are being proposed, like geoengineering and so on. And anything that can be done on a small scale and locally with minimal technology and minimal energy, those are the pathways, those are the solutions that we need to develop. First and foremost, permaculture is another, broad category of strategies that I think is really important to consider. Developed in the 1970s by people who understood the general trajectory that society was going in, and wanted to find techniques that would be useful not only for food production but for social organization and so on. And it's really, if you haven't taken a permaculture design course, there are plenty available in the Portland area and all over the place. So that's also an area of solutions.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in with that, Mike. Just a few minutes left. Once again, let me throw this out. That's sort of a different way of getting that. My attempted question about the big issue of how sort of individual mutants, I consider them mutants, greed hogs and power hogs and male dominant and white dominant power trippers, these are mutant forms of human society that have, because of the historical development of power in society, have been able to gain such traction and power over us, how to deal with them. And with that, I actually lost that train of thought. I think I'll get it back, but go ahead, Richard.
I wish I had a simple solution. You know, the only way we're going to be able to deal with with power hogs of that nature is through force of numbers, over outnumbering them and overpowering them as groups, and that's always a messy process. But the more important thing is to put in place social mechanisms for discouraging that kind of power agglomeration in the first place. We have had some of those social mechanisms in place in democracies, but they're being eroded right now in the stress of the moment, as societies are failing to solve some of their biggest problems. So doing better at solving problems and finding ways of discouraging power over accumulation are really the essence of whether we will survive, whether we will succeed or fail.
Okay, so I got my train of thought back, and since we only have a couple minutes left. So okay, one of the things that really has plagued me, and I've talked about on the show a lot, is okay. So the social change happens, the kind of social change that we're talking about. You know, whether it's voting rights extension, the abolition of slavery, the protection of other species, they tend to happen, through a minority of people, a minority of people who've, they say this whole idea of woke is now a big thing. They're criticizing people for actually waking up and realizing what's actually going on, which is a obviously their only strategy. But anyway, so you have all these different constituencies, people of color, the people, the species that can't speak up for themselves. You have people without wealth. You have people with disabilities. You have all sorts of different constituencies. You have people who are working on all kinds of different issues, but they don't seem to have a really common framework, to my mind, of understanding how we actually got to this point and what we're actually confronted with. And we don't seem to have opportunities to, that's why I pointed to, the socialist and communist movements as being a time in history where actually, a Marxian framework of understanding society was able to gain traction and able to move masses of people, with, vanguards and minority elements in the lead. But so that seems to be, again, I not that your book is going to be the new, Das Kapital, there's lots of other books. Your book came out around the same time as The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity by David Graeber and David Wengrow. And I think in their own way, they're sort of responding to the moment and trying to do something similar. And it seems like a lot of people are searching for that. So anyway, we only have about, 30 seconds left, so I'll let you have the last word.
Right. Yeah, well, that is exactly what I was trying to do with the book, was to provide a common understanding, a point of common understanding for the nexus of issues that we're facing. They all are problems of power. So it's essential that we understand what power is, the dynamics of power, how it works, and how to deal with it going forward. That's what the book is about. And if I've succeeded even 1% in what I've tried to do, I think it will help folks understand and help us all get through this together.
Okay. Well, time flies when you're having fun. Thank you so much, Richard Heinberg. I really appreciate your coming on my show.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Okay. And KBOO.fm, go there, support KBOO, and get a copy of this book if you want it. $60 or more membership pledge. Thank you very much. And thanks, Ty. That's it for the show. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Fight the Empire at 9 a.m. Hey, boo. Yeah.